This podcast is brought to you by Audible. Please visit audiblepodcast.com/GOT for your free audiobook download. This episode is also brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create beautiful websites, blogs, or online stores for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code GOT at checkout to get 10% off. Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 5, Episode 9, titled The Dance of Dragons. Aaron's least favorite episode ever of television, I think.
Dance, Dragolution.
Period. He's seen Power Rangers, he's seen Boy Meets World, and this is his least favorite hour of television.
I don't know if that's accurate to say.
Okay, well, it sounded like it in the instant cast.
We still cover Walking Dead, right?
We do. You're right.
All right. So let's just look calibrate our expectations appropriately.
Okay. What do you think of this episode after the second viewing?
My opinion on the choreography of the initial fighting in the pit improved somewhat.
Mine too, yeah.
My overall impression, the dragon FX were more positive than I expected or than I thought. I think that the sore spot was the moment Danny jumped on his back.
Yeah, I mean, calling it a sore spot kind of, you know, downplays it. I think it looked fucking terrible.
It's not, I kind of was surprised that Sepinwall and Greenwald and some of the professional critics, you know, were praising it as this, like, epic soaring moment and, you know, and debating whether that sugar outweighed the vinegar of the Shireen burning, and no one said that the compositing was terrible and looked fake as hell. Now, that seems to be everywhere else you go. You go into the forums and the Reddits and my email bag, people are like, looks like bullshit. And so weird, because you'd think the actual Drogon running around the arena rampaging and burning shit would be the hard part to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Her, you know, you get a rubber dragon back. And you get a wind, you get a big fan to blow in her face, and you composite a background in there, and you're done.
Yeah, I mean, if I can buy that the 70s Superman was flying, why can't I buy that this dragon is
I real? Believed the man could fly in 1978. I did not believe a woman could fly on a dragon in 2015. It's weird.
No, it's, I don't understand it, because the rest of it looks so good.
And I started to justify, because I remember how rough the direwolves were in season one.
Not so much. But
they were pretty rough.
A little of the compositing, I remember being kind of bad.
And then they kind of nailed it from season two on. And I started thinking, well, maybe. But I'm like, why the fuck would they have? Were they just surprised that Drogon? I mean, like, they had to have known that. It's not an exaggeration to say they would have known that from probably before season one. I think Dance came out between season one and season two. But surely the Double D's knew that this crowning thing was going to happen at some point in the future, and you'd think they'd have, like, you know, a little cottage industry in the back, like, hey, let's see some of this test Danny footage. And this is what they came up with.
I think it was a pet scene of Emilia Clarke. I don't know how you say her name.
I think it's Emilia.
And they were like, look, we don't have the budget, we don't have the time for this, we kind of wanted to do this in the final episode.
She's like, I'm pretty good in Photoshop.
And she's like, you know, I've went to a couple of college courses in editing, video editing, and I think I could give it a shot. And they say they let her.
It was a never ending story.
This was it was real bad.
It was Atreyu and the Luck Dragon. And
anyway, there will be plenty of time to talk about that at the end, I'm sure.
Speaking of 80s synth music, I've been pretty remiss of not shouting out the persons involved in providing us our awesome Game of Thrones 80s television remix theme. It's Highway Superstar, and they're really cool. They got a lot of good stuff. You can go to their SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/Highway Superstar. And I've got that link in every single show notes for every one of our Game of Thrones podcasts. So if you ever want to know, pop over to show notes. It's the link at the bottom.
Okay. What about the people who made the episode?
It's written by the Double D's. Although they were, I felt like in the behind the scenes, the insider, they were all like, George made us do it. Did you get that?
I only watched bits and pieces of it. I didn't watch the whole thing.
Yeah, it's almost like they felt like, woof, this is going to be really brutal. Want to make sure people know that this isn't a deviation from the, because doesn't, you know, this is all future events. Like from the moment Stannis rode forth from Winterfell, essentially.
Yeah,
we are kind of at beyond the books, certainly now. So they wrote it with some bullet points and whatever by Martin. It's directed by David Nutter, who's known as the Pilot Whisperer because he has been brought on to film an unusual number of pilots for television series. He's done work. He's directed 6 episodes of Game of Thrones, including the Fantastic Reigns of Castamere. That's the Red Wedding episode. He's currently working on The Flash, Arrow, Homeland. He's directed ER, The Sopranos, X-Files. My personal favorite, Space Above and Beyond.
That's a lot of shows.
Yeah, he goes back into the mid 80s. I don't know why he seems to have trouble like the director before the last with directing some action sequences. Because I will, you know, when we get to there, I will talk plenty of shit about especially the Unsullied.
Okay. Yeah.
The Unsullied
have been
warped into oblivion at this point. Yep. I don't even know what to say.
Yep. All right.
So I got even more feedback than I did last week, but majority of it is predictable. Mm-hmm. Stannis rage. I'm going to just get it out of the way. I'm going to read a few select out of context quotes that I pulled from my mailbag.
Okay.
Screw Stannis.
Yep.
Fuck Stannis. Mm-hmm. I'm starting my own death list a la Arya Stark, and he's leading the list. Utterly devastated, soul-crushing, Jump the Shark can now be replaced by Road the Dragon. Stannis needs the full Ramsay treatment. Stannis makes me fucking sick. I've never been close enough to turn off the show and never watching again. Mm-hmm. Stannis, if you need to take the throne like this, I hope you die.
Yep.
I think that was direct tweeted at him too. I will never forgive the Double D's for this. I now understand what show-only watchers felt when Ned lost his head, when the wedding turned red, and when the Viper went dead. Stannis and Melisandre are now on my death list. My love for Stannis is unsalvageable. It made me physically sick. It ruined the evening for me. I was livid.
Yeah.
And on and on. That's just a choice, small non-repetitive sample. Quotes. Yeah.
Yeah.
People pissed at Stannis.
Sure. I was equally pissed at Stannis. And I had the luxury, I guess, of never really caring that much for Stannis. I've kind of viewed him as the guy who had the best claim. But, you know, I like I said before, I didn't really understand him. I didn't really like him that much. Now I fucking hate him.
Well, it's weird because usually when we've had... I didn't really care much about Stannis until I got to, like, Feast and Dance because it seemed like he was positioned to be... the pragmatic choice of, bringing us justice to the Boltons, the Freys, the Lannisters, etc. Mm-hmm. And it's weird because most of the time when we've been set up like that, the hero gets killed. Mm-hmm. This is just like his original purpose seems to be perverted. It's almost worse. Like him getting his head cut off, it's like, well, you know, I still backed the right guy. He just lost his head. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
This, it's like, I don't know. It's like, it's such a visceral, like, you know, betrayal.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and we'll find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
I agree. Why don't we get into the recap, yeah?
Yeah, let's do it.
We'll have time to talk about all this stuff.
All right.
It's the middle of the night. Stannis' camp catches fire. And in the morning, Davos reports the damage. And he kind of wonders aloud, you know, what the hell they're going to do. They're stuck between going back to Castle Black or going on to Winterfell. And Stannis just looks over at Melisandre.
Yeah, that fucking Red Witch didn't see this coming, did she? Staring in her flames
she
late
did about
at night.
30 seconds before it happened.
right.
But yeah.
She's got the TiVo of of foreknowledge. About 30 seconds that she can, you know.
They're on a delay, yeah.
Oh, God. Ramsay's few good men, surprisingly effective.
Yeah, it seemed like it. And it seemed like it started to break the spirit of a lot of people there, too. Certainly Davos was in bad shape mentally.
Yeah, I didn't think the episode got off to a great start because they established that clearly the camp was guarded. They had men patrolling it, even with it being as cold as it was and whatever.
Yeah.
And yet still these guys infiltrated the camp and surgically burnt the food stores, the weapon stores. They set horses on fire. Very, very attack of, you know,
that's
Mars
pretty cool.
Attacks moment.
Okay.
I like that, but I don't know, man. That's... Ugh. The 20 good men strategy I thought was kind of dumb, and I'm surprised it worked. And fuck,
I thought
fuck
it was Randy. Too. I mean, like, I didn't think the 20 good men could do much damage to it. Like, you don't have a guy guarding the food stores, like a series of people guarding the important resources of this army.
See, I actually expected this. I talked in a spoiler cast about how I could see them like riding through and setting things on fire, and that makes Stannis, forces him into a rash action. Like he's not quite ready, but he's got to because now they don't have shelter.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it did that. It did goad him into rash action. It's not the rash action I wish he'd taken, but
certainly.
I don't know.
Yeah, it seems surprisingly effective. Then we go up to Jon at the wall, and he arrives with wildlings, and Alistair, you know, looks at him from the wall for a minute, and everybody's wondering, is he going to let him in? Isn't he? And he eventually does.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just a couple of scenes where they're all talking about, you know, John views it as a failure, Sam doesn't, Alistair says, you know, a lot of shit's going bad because of your bleeding heart.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know why Alistair is so angry about this. Like, does he think that the wildlings are going to eat them from within? Does he think that
yes.
Really? He does?
Well, I think there's the concern that they literally will eat them from within. Like, we don't have enough food to feed the few hundred men we have left. Now we brought 5,000 or plus people south of the wall who are sick, wounded, and injured, and it's too late to start farming because I don't know if you've noticed, but it's fucking snowing. Winter has come.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do? And then you also have the, they'll probably slit our throats too. Like if things go bad and there has to be a fight between
who gets...
I don't
know. I think the people at Castle Black are more likely to slit the wildlings' throats, given the looks.
But that's the way it works, right? A lot of your fears about the other, you know, and I'm using that in the kind of like the archetypal sense, not like the White Walker, but your fears about the other are often reflections of your worst thoughts of what you would do in their place.
Okay.
Constrained by none of your positive qualities.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's thinking, hey, if I got a chance, I'd murder them all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're bad guys. I'm good guys. So fuck.
Okay. Ollie also doesn't look happy. He gives him John the stink eye when he comes back. And then we go up to Stannis again, or down to Stannis, I guess. He sends Davos to Castle Black to get some supplies and some food and stuff like that, horses. And before he leaves, Davos stops in to see Shireen, and he gives her a gift to say thank you for teaching him to read. Nice little moment there between the two of them.
Yeah, nice little heartwarming scene to make sure we're all going to be really fucking sick about what happens.
Yep.
It seems like the emailers, we had a debate about whether we thought Davos really thought Stannis would do this. And I thought that no. He was worried about it, but I'm going to trust my king. Do you think that that's an accurate reading? Because I had a lot of people thinking that he actually did know, but he's a kind of a company man type
of
thing.
I thought that he trusted Stannis not to do that.
What happens between their relationship now?
I think it's over. That's a rift that he's shown his true colors, you know?
Yeah.
He's on board with Melisandre no matter the cost to anyone. And I don't know that Davos can put up with that.
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of like the tension between them and Gendry, which was Stannis' illegitimate nephew, only much larger and much more personal stakes for him.
Yeah.
The real problem is I don't know where that leaves him. You know, if Stannis dies in this coming assault, I could see him having a role of rallying the troops back to the wall, although he's going to have a hard time rallying all these Baratheon troops to fight for the wall when they themselves have not seen the White Walkers or anything like that.
Sure.
Then he'd have to deal with Melisandre because she's a problem.
Yeah, I'm really not sure how that's all going to play out, but it seems like Davos is going to come back. He's going to find out what happened, and he's going to have to make a call. It's possible that the battle just goes on, and Davos gets back, and the battle's kind of over.
Could be. The more interesting possibility is, what if Stannis wins?
Sure.
And it's seen as this great victory for the Lord of Light. I mean, I don't know. I really don't know.
Well, that's the question. Like, he's always trusted Melisandre's magic because it's worked in the past in some nebulous way.
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't work this time, she's in some serious fucking trouble.
Yeah.
She's dead. And I'm really hoping that's how it goes. I'm hoping Stannis gets his just desserts by killing his daughter and having nothing come of it.
Yeah.
And then Melisandre gets hers by being killed by Stannis. That's what I would like to see. And then Roose comes in and kills them all.
Yeah, I mean,
because I'm more on Roose's side now. Roose is a better guy than Stannis, in my opinion.
Here's the thing:
his son, fuck his son, but Roose is better.
The only magic that we've actually seen incontrovertible proof that has actually worked and not been some kind of coincidence or stage magic, was when she gave the Shadow Baby, which was semen magic. It wasn't blood magic.
Okay.
And I know that Thoros of Myr, the guy who brought Beric Dondarrion back, did not have to burn anyone alive to do that. He just prayed to his god and it happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm starting to... I'm wondering if the show will establish that this has been a bunch of bullshit and tricks and it's going to crap out on them at the worst narrative possible time. And then Stannis will realize he's been duped. And
that's where I hope it's going.
Yeah, but that, like, is that going to be fun to watch?
No, but it results in it. Well, kind of. I mean, it's fun to watch Cersei in the dungeon, right? Sucking water off the ground because you hate her so much.
I guess.
I would love to see Melisandre.
But even Cersei loves
going
her children.
Up in flames.
She's got good cheekbones and she loves her children. I mean, that's her claim to fame. Like, Stannis has lost all that stuff.
Sure, but I'm talking about, like, if it doesn't work and he kills Melisandre, yeah, I want to see that.
Yeah, no, but I mean, the good news is the Battle of Winterfell, it's going to be it's no longer a Martin classic, good versus evil, evil triumphs. Essentially, no matter who wins, or who loses, we win. Like,
okay.
He destroys the Boltons, all right, fine. Boltons destroy him, I'm fine with that now, too.
But
there's a zero stakes battle coming up now.
But also one of them wins, right?
Yeah, sure.
So the other side is one of the bad guys wins.
At that point, you're debating lesser of two evils. I'm just saying it's equally as satisfying to see Stannis get his comeuppance as it is to see Roose Bolton and his get hit their comeuppance.
Yeah. Okay. I agree with that.
Probably slightly more satisfying. I mean, that's the other thing is Jesus. We've kind of thought, like, okay, well, maybe Sansa gets liberated by Stannis. Stannis liberates Winterfell. You know, Sansa has the blood of king, the Stark kings of old. 300 years ago, they were legit kings of the North until the Targaryens came and made them all kneel. Is Sansa going to, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if it works, it works.
When they have to cross the Riverlands at the Twins, and you know, Frey's being obstinate, is he going to be like, trot out the Stark girl? Like, there's just no savior left.
Sure, and it could be the Littlefinger's the savior, right? Littlefinger comes riding in and saves Sansa. I mean, they're set up kind of for that.
Sure, maybe Meryn Trant will save the day too. I mean, we're putting our faith in
dude. No, they've established that though. They've established like Littlefinger saying, you know, I can go in and mop up the rest of this.
Yeah, sure.
After the fact, he might be able to come in and save her. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway,
having a hard time getting excited about either of those possibilities.
Yeah, I understand. We go over to Dorne. And Doran is telling Jaime that he's going to send Tristan and Marcella back to King's Landing. And they also agree to release Bronn on one condition. This is the beginning of, I guess, Doran putting, what is her name? Ilaria? Kind of in her place again. Uh-huh. You know, like saying your rebellion's over. He does that later on. But here you can see that it's clear she's the one who sent that necklace.
Yeah.
And he understands that. And he's going to, you know, what kind of gloss over it for now, but later he'll get back to it.
Yeah, I mean, that was interesting because I thought the interesting possibility would be for Cersei to have planted that to just as an overreaction get Marcella back. Mm-hmm. I 9 episodes in, this Dorne plot's just been horseshit.
I just want to see more from it, right? Like, I want to see Doran do more.
Nothing that I've seen from it so far makes me want to see more of it.
Except for that actor.
Yes,
that
I
actor
guess.
Is the thing that I want to see.
And the guy playing
I
want to
see him.
His kind of big axe wielding bodyguard.
Yeah, he's cool.
Is cool too. But it's like I need them to start doing something. And I guess there's the beginning of some emailers are trying to piece together like maybe what his master plan is going to be, putting Tristane on the small council, getting Marcella in King's Landing. But this has been 9 episodes of really rough slogging, and this slapping scene that we're about to talk about.
I don't see the point of it, but yeah, let's go there. A couple of the Sand Snakes are playing some game where they're slapping hands, and then they come in and grab Bronn, and they take him to the throne room, and he gets punched in the face.
I think the Double D's thought that the Sand Snakes would be a hit on the scale of Oberyn, that they would be like his big, over-the-top, colorful warrior daughters, and we would all love them, and we would love to see... Like, I don't know that they understood why we liked Oberyn. I
liked Oberyn because he was charismatic, kind of freewheeling. He had a righteous cause. Like, those are kind of the things that I liked about Oberyn. And also, he was a badass. I've seen almost none of that from these Sand Snakes.
No. Mm-mm.
They're not charming. I mean,
they don't
maybe
Tyene
like... is a little charming, but in a weird, kind of creepy, sexual way.
Yeah.
They haven't shown to be huge badasses like Oberyn.
They've tried, but it's all been laughable. And part of that is like, I wonder if the Water Garden scene had been better, like just in the staging, in the setup, and in the actual execution. If we would be like, oh, okay, yeah, because I didn't like. There was some people that were turning on them just when they showed their faces. Like, look at this fucking, you know, glorious ladies of wrestling armor they're wearing and this cheesy speeches they're giving. I actually thought that was all cool. Like, I'm fine with that.
I didn't have a huge problem with it, yeah.
I turned on them when the Water Gardens thing went to shit. Mm. And now it's
I've just never really connected with them, you know? It's not like a moment where I said, fuck those ladies. I don't want anything to do with them. It's more of just like, they've never really excited me.
Right. But this, like I said, this slapping, you were indifferent about the slapping scene because I've moved to outright scorn. Like, this is two minutes of my life that could be spent better else in many different places in this episode.
I mean, is the point to show that Tyene has, like, this violent lashing out side to her? Or, like, she's kind of a loose cannon? What?
Like, I don't care about any of these three characters enough to want to even decide, like, okay, what does this mean? The little one's got a little kid complex, but she's quick and wily, and she's been waiting for years to tag her sister back. Now she, like, this is the Slapsgiving episode of How I Met Your Mother.
Okay.
Only I don't care about any of the characters. See, there you go. That's exactly how I feel about the Sand Snakes.
I don't get that reference, but
I don't. Right. That's what I'm saying. That's exactly how I feel about watching this episode.
All right. Maybe it has to do with the small man and large man stuff that comes later on.
Well,
I don't
know. Obara, the spear welding one, should have gotten him bitch slapped them both.
I agree.
She's,
I would like to see that anyway.
She's clearly the brawny one in this relationship, so she should have got up and laid down the law.
Indeed. Arya is doing her oyster thing, and she's about to poison the thin man when she sees Meryn Trant getting off a boat, and she's compelled to stare and follow and gawk the whole time. While Mace leads them around the city singing a song, which annoys both the guy from the Iron Bank and Meryn Trant.
Sure.
Which I was happy about. Mace is so ridiculous, man.
Yeah, my notes are, I keep on saying, like, Mance, I said, Jesus, Mance is the worst. Nope, wrong, Meryn Trant is the worst. oh, fuck all that. Stannis is definitely the worst. Like, Mace yeah. would be the worst thing in any given episode, except for these guys are just hell-bent on having worst character of the year award given to them. Because he's, I mean, Mace is just bad at what he's there to do.
He's harmless, but he's inept, and he's annoying, and...
Like, I didn't think I could think Cersei was stupider or less capable in statescraft.
Yeah.
Because I was giving her the benefit of the doubt. I thought she was sending him off to Braavos to die.
Me too.
Meryn Trant was going to knife him and toss him overboard, mm-hmm. and there'd be some kind of cover story. No, she really sent this guy to treat with the Iron Bankers, and it's a disaster.
I guess my question would be, who else does she send? Does she send Pycelle?
Well, Qyburn.
Does she send Qyburn?
Yeah.
Like, these guys are all just as crazy in their own ways.
Well, if she's going to recall Littlefinger for something,
there you go.
Littlefinger would be able to. But, you know, Mace is going to come back and, like, good news, our interest rates are twice as high and we have half the time to repay him. He said something about just not liking my face.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I look like a Muppet version of a planetary governor from Star Trek The Next Generation.
I offered
direct
him
quote.
A barrel of wine and he
and he said I've actually been 15 years sober. Yeah. And it's like, it just went downhill.
He showed
from
me
there.
His chip. God damn it.
Oh, God. It's a farce, man.
All right. We'll talk about the Arya stuff because I know you're dying to.
Not really.
No,
this is a terrible handling of
I mean.
Very good book material.
Yeah.
It's happening kind of like it goes down in the books. It's just not well executed, man.
What was your feeling on Arya in the books? Because I get the feeling that they're almost trying to show us that she's not good at this yet. Was that the tone of it in the books, or were you kind of on board with Arya being a badass?
Oh, yeah.
At this point?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And
really?
she was young and she was brash and she was overconfident and she's kind of bratty. But she did pay attention to her craft, and there was a there's a lot more kind of Miyagi-ing happening with the Faceless Men, where they were actually teaching her lessons and humility and how to, and you know, the tension's always been, she knows what she's doing, will she live up to that training when she's tested? But this is just like you said, like she just completely abandoned a mission with a drop jaw and stagger around staring at these guys. I don't know who that's doesn't work for me. Did it work? So
no,
you're sure. Yeah.
It
okay.
didn't work for me either.
Like, it didn't even play. I was thinking like, well, maybe if you don't know how subtle and nuanced and kind of epic this is in the books, this would play okay. But on second watches, I'm just like, cause I've had this happen before where I'm just disappointed that it didn't happen like it happened in the books. Mm-hmm. But on the subsequent watches, I was like, no, this is just really less interesting.
Yeah, it just feels clunky. I don't know that I like the way they did it. It might have been cool if they had done something where Arya was being a little more stealthy or just a little bit better at this and a little bit handled the situation better.
Falls apart. Making Meryn Trant be this giant pedophile felt kind of clumsy too. I don't know that I needed 5 minutes of him saying too old. Like, you know, Sir Chris.
Well, it didn't
of House,
help that they started
Sir,
with Elena.
Sir Chris of House Hansen needed to bust in. Their house words. Have a seat over there. I don't know. I mean, so it's blindingly obvious what's going to happen now, right?
I think so. Arya is going to try to sneak her way in
He needs a fresh one for tomorrow because apparently he has to pound underage pussy every day or his dick falls off.
Yeah, he melts like the Wicked Witch.
It's not great. And just the visual of a raw shellfish merchant going around in a whorehouse with a plate of oysters
It reminded me of like the people at the baseball games who have like the popcorn and the peanuts and stuff.
When you want to sell, I mean, things I want sold at a whorehouse are things that are individually packaged. I can verify.
Well, oysters kind of are, right? They come in shells.
She
cracks them open right in front of you. It's not like she's.
The problem is they look like jizz in a shell. How am I supposed to verify that there have not been jizzed on? I mean,
I don't know what more you want. If they're in the shell, I don't know how you could get the jizz in there.
And then the, you know, it's like the other thing is like, even this wasn't too on the nose for them. They had to throw in two random dudes propositioning her for her clam that she didn't handle at all. She's just kind of like, wow, I can't believe that happened. Like, you were just menaced on the streets of Braavos like a week ago.
Yeah,
like I kind of
ready
wanted
to kill.
I kind of wanted her to be like, I feel like this character is a lot more, has a lot more gumption to her, and the way she's she played it in this episode, it was very flat and single minded. And I didn't think it was very interesting.
I mean, isn't that kind of who the Faceless Men are turning her into, though? The single minded, flat. I mean, that's what Jacken is, right?
Do you think Jacken is not interesting?
No, but he wouldn't be fazed by someone coming up and asking for his clam. I know that wouldn't happen, but
I don't think he would just stare at them. I think he would have like
he would
some
probably
kind
just
of,
walk on. I don't.
You don't think he would be like a man thinks he should back the fuck off
during a mission? I don't.
And
know.
And if they kept
know.
Hassling him, I think they'd end up with their pillar and stones cut off and shoved down their throat.
Maybe.
And I think Arya is starting to be capable. Like the. Here's where I want Arya to be in this development. I want Arya to where I just think she can handle the average dude on the street. Like,
sure.
There's no question in my mind that she would just fuck them up.
I want her there too, but I don't know that she is there yet. Like, she hasn't learned enough about the actual art of fighting.
I agree, but we've had 9 episodes in this goddamn season, and I'm surprised we're not there. And since
she's learning other lessons at the moment.
And the other thing is, like, if they're taking their time, it's weird that, like, they're dragging their feet about some things, but they're also really quickly advancing beyond the books on others. And I just don't get it. Like, if you're going to take your time to tell Arya's story, then take your time to tell her story. I don't know. It feels both slow and rushed at the same time.
Okay. Weird. Anyway, so Trent and his men head into a whorehouse, and Arya follows him inside. And we watch him search for the youngest whore in Braavos. And then Trant asks for a fresh one tomorrow, and Arya is shooed out of the place. And then she goes back to Jacken and tells him the thin man wasn't hungry. And then he doesn't look like he believes her, in my opinion.
There's people wanted us to debate that in the email, and I don't think there's a debate to be had. This is a man who can tell when she's lying about going down the left or right alley.
And whether or not she hated the Hound, like...
No, he knows.
It's pretty obvious.
So I think
he knows.
This is actually the most interesting thing about this development. The fact that he knows she's gone off script.
Yeah.
And is just kind of letting it happen. And to what end? I'm kind of fascinated by that aspect of it.
Yeah, me too. He's definitely far more interesting.
But I also think that Arya was a pretty piss poor liar about it, too. It had been, again, if it's a shame, because if the stuff that came before it was handled better, I think that would be really super interesting. It's interesting enough just in isolation, but if there was a little bit more intrigue, if there's a little bit more subtlety into way she just, you know, jumped off page, I think it would have worked better.
I mean, all of my problems with that storyline really come down to this episode. You know, everything else before it, I've kind of been on board with. It's been a little confusing, and there's been a lot of, like, the man can't tell the girl, all of this stuff, and... a little runaround there, but I think it's been going to a place that they really just didn't get to this episode. And I hope they get to, I hope they deal with the fact that Jacken knows next episode. Cause if they don't and they wait the whole season, I'm going to be kind of rolling my eyes, just going, oh God, I got to wait another season to see this.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, maybe they're hoping to build, because I don't know what kind of, you know, every season of Game of Thrones, it follows like a kick in the crotch and then kind of hope for the future is episode 10. So you don't just like rage quit the show. Yeah. And I'm starting to think, like, you know what? Like, if she kills Meryn Trant in some kind of epic fashion with the Stark theme playing, is that going to be enough to kind of rinse the Shireen taste out of our mouth? Stannis like vanquishing the Boltons on the field of battle? I feel like that would have worked, except for he just, you know.
Yeah, I can't root for that anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know. I really hope she kills Trant next episode, because if she doesn't, then there's not much hope at the end of that.
Okay. I don't know. They got to throw us a bone somewhere. Just wonder where it's going to be.
That could be cool. So then we get Doran telling Ilaria that she can swear her allegiance or she can die, and she kneels down and kisses his ring. Man, this scene, these moments with Doran are why I want to see more of this guy.
Sure.
The look on his face and his line, like, I believe in second chances. I don't believe in third chances.
Yeah.
He's got to be so good. They're just not doing anything with him.
I know, and he's Oberyn's brother. We expect him to be more than he seems, and why are they not getting to that part?
I don't know, man, but I'm really rooting for it. I want to see it. Then we go to Alaria letting Jaime know that she doesn't disapprove of him and that Cersei, or of him and Cersei's relationship. You know, he's just kind of a victim of the times, I guess.
Yeah.
And then she tells him that she knows his daughter didn't have a part in killing Oberyn, and maybe he didn't either.
But you know what? No one had a part in killing Oberyn, but Oberyn himself.
The Mountain. If you want to be mad at someone, be mad at the Mountain.
He volunteered for this as a way to humiliate the Lannisters, and it blew up in his face.
Yeah.
Because of his own cocksuredness.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of he lived as he died. I really don't get this put upon angle by her.
No, I feel like she's just angry. Like, we're supposed to read this as she is just angry that her lover died, and that's it. End of story. I'm going to get back at somebody whether they deserve it or not.
But, I mean, I don't know. The way they're manifesting that just seems, I don't know. Like, it's hard for me.
You know what the problem is? They haven't had a character tell her that.
Well,
no one had anything to do with this. This is just you making a mountain out of a molehill.
But do you think Oberyn, like, he volunteered for this? This is all, like, above the board. You don't think he shared his plan with her?
No. That's not what I'm saying. Okay. After the fact, like, she gets all angry and wants revenge on someone. She doesn't know where to turn, so she kind of takes revenge on everyone.
Uh-huh.
No one has told her that. Like, Doran should be the one telling her, look, no one made Oberyn do this. It's his own fault.
But here, okay.
No one else is at fault for this.
I guess
they would just say it.
I guess my read on the situation is the woman that Oberyn would decide to take for his lifelong paramour is some kind of woman. A very impressive woman.
You would
woman.
Think so, yeah.
I kind of want her to be more on the Doran script. Like, maybe you leave the Sand Snakes to be the young, impetuous, wanton just, because they weren't there. They didn't know how it went down. But I kind of expect her to be more Rathacon, revenge is a dish best served cold, more intelligent, more calculating, more like, what are we going to do? Not like demanding things, let's cut off little girls' fingers and stuff. It feels like my impression of her character was more interesting and more of a person that Oberyn would be captivated by than the reality I'm seeing in this season.
Okay. I can get behind that. It seems like they both are similarly lustful for revenge and, you know, in the bedroom and all that stuff. But Oberyn had a way of getting what he wanted that didn't involve everyone else knowing immediately.
And he picked the spots. Like, yes, he can bully Lannister soldiers because they can't do anything against him, and he can kill them all if he had to anyway. But he didn't, like, bust into King's Landing going right up to Lord Tywin and be like, you killed my sister, prepare to die.
Yeah.
You know, he waited and picked his spot and picked his moment. There's no real subtlety here.
No, there isn't. You're right.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. the thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
So we're sponsored this week by Squarespace, which is a website that allows you to build websites very easily without any prior knowledge. As you guys know, Aaron and I were both web developers in a previous life, and we have a lot of experience with this, and I tested out Squarespace product, and I think it makes the whole process super easy. You go in, you literally, you click on what you want your site to look like, you answer a couple of questions, and boom, you've got a site.
So Sir Davos...
Okay.
He's in the market for a new career now. He's kind of been he's got some dissatisfaction with his current employer. He's wanting to get out of the Onion Knight game. The whole onion smuggling business is seen better days. It's behind him. Wanting to start a cottage industry selling finely crafted wooden figurines. One-arm whittler.com is what he wants to start. What would you say to Sir Davos?
I would say, Sir Davos, you can go to squarespace.com. You can sign up with the offer code GOT and get a website for $8 a month. 8 pieces of silver a month, Davos.
So 8 cheap. Silver stags? Wow.
I think that's cheap in the Game of Thrones world. I have no idea, but it's cheap in the real world for $8. Now, what can sell one product on that website, and if you want to sell stags, let it be stags. If maybe you're a little dissatisfied with the way things went down this week, you can start selling...
Direwolves?
Yeah.
Dragon brooches?
Sure, yeah. You can make Danny's necklace, sell that.
What if the fingers on one hand are much shorter than the others? Is that a hindrance at all to using...
No, because, I mean, really, even if you're a hunt and pecker, you're just using one finger to type... You can do it pretty quickly still. I mean, it might take, 2 minutes instead of 30 seconds. But, most of it's done with the mouse. You just click on what you like.
Sir Davos might take offense at being called a pecker.
Well, I don't think he truly understands what I meant then. He's not as smart as I thought he was. And now that he can read, he can easily.
Do you have to be smart to use Squarespace?
I suppose that's not a requirement. No,
it's that easy.
Actually, there's a lot of things you don't need to use Squarespace. A credit card is one. You can sign up for this free trial without a credit card.
That's good because he's just got the stags.
I know,
wooden and silver, either way, not credit cards.
Definitely. Go to squarespace.com. Use the offer code GOT when you make your first purchase to get 10% off of the already low price. You don't even need a credit card, like I said, to start that 14-day free trial. Go check it out. So Stannis visits Shireen. He tells her he must fulfill his destiny. She asks if she can help, and he burns her alive. Or he lets Melisandre burn her alive.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the Dance of the Dragons being a disaster... everyone's saying like, oh, well, that sounds like a shit story with a bunch of stupid stuff happening.
Yeah.
And this episode's called Dance of Dragons. Maybe that's like them having fun with the concept that this is a total shit show and it's all intentional.
And you shouldn't choose sides.
I don't know. Like, that's kind of a meta analysis I'm trying to get behind that this, mm-hmm. some of this stuff is intentionally bad and we're supposed to hate it and think it's stupid to set up something brilliant later on. I hope.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be nice if they at least knew the effect that this was going to have on the audience.
Yeah.
And I get the impression that they're aware that maybe, like, they understand, yeah, when we do this, people are going to flip their fucking lids.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they also seem very calm and cold about it. Like, mm-hmm. when you watch the behind-the-scenes stuff, you're like, Stannis is a guy who doesn't break his promises, who doesn't change his mind. When he commits to a thing, he does it.
Sure.
And that's, like, all they say about it, you know? They don't say, like, this... this was extremely heartbreaking, or like all this emotional stuff that goes on with a father burning his daughter.
Yeah, it's all about the mechanics of
it. It's like, why did Stannis do this? What was going through his head? Like,
yeah.
Not like, what is this going to do to our already traumatized audience?
Sure. Well, I mean, there's only so much you can worry about that. You just, if the story calls for more trauma at this point in time, then you gotta lay it on, and they either hang with it or they don't. But
yeah.
My problem is, and I want to say to reasonable people can disagree about this. I don't think, like, surely there's not a person that said, I love the sand snake slapping scene. It's the greatest thing ever. I think that's just pretty much universally seen as terrible. But I think reasonable people can disagree about whether this is a fundamental destruction or deviation from Stannis' character. My gut take is yes, it is. And I'm kind of angry about it. But I don't know that I know that much about Stannis, and, you know, I don't know what he does in the next book. So it could be that this is George plan's plan all along. And a lot of the Westerosi, like, savior myths about the prince that was promised and Azor Ahai, like the original Azor Ahai murdered his wife in the making of the Lightbringer sword. That was one of the key elements.
Okay.
So there's kind of this with great events, you have to do great sacrifice, kind of the same thing that Hizdar is about to say before he gets a blade stuck in his chest.
Yeah,
but it could be thematically we'll see that this is a piece of Stannis, that this is, you know, and they threw in the whole, like, you're my daughter, the princess of Baratheon, and I love you. They threw that in just to make the stakes really, really high, and to make the betrayal that much amped up. But it's in Stannis's character to do whatever he needs to do to save the realm. But my take on Stannis was, I don't know, that he never wanted to be king. He's got a very regimented view of how he sees the rules and justice in the world, and he's got the best claim, and everybody else is fucking idiots, and they are, and that he has to do this to save the people.
That's weird, because it feels to me like it. Maybe the idea of being king has gone to his head, but it felt like,
well,
he was doing it out of some sort of destiny fulfillment thing, because he basically says that.
And it could be also that Melisandre is doing all this. This is kind of like King Theon from Lord of the Rings situation, where he's being ensorcelled and doing stuff out. He's doing stuff. You know, Saruman possessed the one king and made him all old and gray, and then Gandalf came and smacked him in the head with the staff, and he became young again.
Okay, yeah.
That kind of situation. And I wonder, like, if he'll, at a later date, like, Melisandre will die and he'll come to and just, like, you know, be suicidal or something.
A couple of seasons ago, I was thinking, like, when he was threatening to kill Davos.
Yeah.
I was kind of thinking, man, this doesn't feel like his character, you know? Yeah. It feels strange, like he's being manipulated and controlled by Melisandre. And that's kind of when I started hating her.
Yeah.
But... yeah, I don't know. I mean, that doesn't excuse his actions, I don't think.
Well, I mean, like, so this is the guy who survived the siege of Storm's End, which, that's how, you know, Davos the Onion Knight made his bones. He sailed in with the last minute shipment of onions, and that, because Stannis was eating horses, he ate rats, they ate belt leather. The man would rather die than give up in the face of adversity. And a snowstorm shows up and his supplies get burnt, and he just jumps to burning his daughter. Like, that's the other thing, is I guess I needed...
But he's not giving up, right?
No, he's not giving up.
He's just resorting to, you know, the equivalent, the family equivalent of eating rats. Like, this is all we've got left, let's go for it.
I don't think they did a very good job of showing the desperation. Like, one pain over a huddled night, shivering in the cold, was... And he, like, you can even see it in the men's faces when they go to burn him. Like, they're not really on board with this.
No.
And Stannis is already an unlikable guy. How is he going to effectively lead anyone after this?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's what makes it extra intolerable for me, is that you don't see that desperation. Like, so a couple of tents burned, you know? Yeah. Like, you never showed me the stakes, really.
Yeah. Would that be interesting that, you know, let's say this burning does do something miraculous and they're victorious over the Boltons, and then his men, like, they've appointed some leader amongst themselves, they stab him in the back and cut. Because the thing is, it would have felt more consistent with Stannis' character if they go to start doing this, or maybe Melisandre doesn't, he has since, but at the moment, this is a guy who wasn't even all that pissed when Jon Snow killed Mance as a way of mercy.
Yeah.
I thought he was going to pull, that Selyse was going to be all for it. He's going to pull Shireen down and put Selyse up there, and it gets rid of one loathsome character. It's still kind of problematic because he's burning this girl's mother in front of her. But,
just to go
this full-blown on, and Selyse, the crazy, creepy, deformed fetus lady, is the one who's pleading for mercy at the end, it just felt like a real switcheroo to me. And people said, well, it was obvious that he was going to do this. I think, yes, they were obviously foreshadowing it, and I was thinking that they were then going to not do the obvious thing. And that's why I guess my gut feels really punched, because I was really...
Yeah.
You know, it's a classic Braveheart. Here's the guys. They've infiltrated the castle wall. They're watching this go down. They're going to stop it. They're not stopping it.
I mean, I agree with you. I was thinking the entire time, okay, Stannis, change your mind here. Step in. Do the right thing. The fact that he never did, I mean, it just reinforces the idea of what show you're watching, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is a show with the Red Wedding. This is a show with Ned being killed. This is, like... All the things where in television you would normally see the turnaround and the last minute save, you're not going to see here.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's damn near impossible to watch. It's brutal.
This Cary Ingram, who plays Princess Shireen, is pretty amazing in her scenes with Davos and her father, and then actually being burned at the stake.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's anything more to say. Like, I've seen persuasive arguments that this is all thematically consistent and consistent with his characters. And I'm saying they're wrong. And we're going to read kind of like both sides of that issue and the feedback. But my personal gut says, I see your intellectual arguments, but my gut is saying that they're bullshit.
Of course.
So.
Of course. I don't. You'd have to be heartless for that not to be the case. There is one good thing that comes of Shireen burning. For sure.
Which
is that Davos doesn't have to find the vendor he bought that statue from, because he doesn't have to give her the second one.
Okay. I got a surprising email for you.
Okay. The great games begin. Dario and Hisdar argue about whether the small man or the larger man will win. The large man wins. Jorah comes out. He wins a Royal Rumble. And then the Sons of the Harpy attack, and they surround Dany. Hisdar is killed. Dario, Jorah, and Tyrion... and the Unsullied, you know, to some degree, are protecting Dany and Missandei. And then everything looks hopeless, and Drogon swoops in, and she rides him off into the sunset.
There's a couple things on here that I really liked. I really liked the Dario just laying it on thick.
And then, to have the small man get killed.
But literally cock-blocking Hisdar. Okay. Like wedging his body between, you know, Dany and him, and just showing him up. And even Dany, like, starting to make fun and emasculating Hisdar. I thought that was interesting. And I thought that's like, man, this is going to be really cool. Like, to see them, you know, because obviously I knew the Drogon sweeps and takes Dany away. And I'm like, and then you're left with these guys. And what do they do? And I'm like, ooh, it's going to be really interesting to see, like, these two powerful men, like, duke it out in this small council. You know, what's their relationship going to be like? And then they killed Hisdar.
Yep.
And I'm like, what the fuck? I also thought they did a really good job. Like, I was really amazed, like, you know, because this is kind of a debate in the books. It doesn't go down like this, but like, who is the person behind the Sons of Harpies is essentially the question. Who is engineering this debacle?
Yeah.
And some people say it's Hisdar. Some people say this other guy, but it's kind of like very intentionally ambiguous.
Okay.
So I was like, wow, Hisdar slinking in and bit him. He's like, I had to make some final preparations, pass out some gold masks.
Exactly.
Get some swords going. I'm like, this is really heavy handed. And then they killed him. And I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah, definitely not Hisdar.
Is he like a patsy? Is he
a martyr?
Was he a useful idiot that they used to get to this situation? But then How did the Sons of Harpies know that they were she was going to propose marriage and be at her side the whole time? He was in prison. Like, it's really hard for me to comprehend the Sons of Harpies plot. Also, the other thing that was interesting is that the Sons of Harpies seem to like they're from all walks of marine life. Although, because they're dressed, some of them are dressed as like kind of the commoner, the former slave attire. Some of them are dressed like the wise masters. But they almost exclusively killed wise masters in the crowd. And Unsullied.
I'm not certain about that.
I saw a bunch of them pushing past the common people, but I don't think I saw a single person die on screen. And I was looking for it.
There's a shitload of them dead though. If you look around the Colosseum as like Drogon's doing his thing, you can just see body after body of the former slaves.
Really?
I mean, I think what happened is a lot of the former masters are sitting behind Dany. Like, they're kind of clustered.
So they're...
And so, like, yeah, they do push past her, but I think they're going after Dany when they're doing that.
They're in the box seats. They're in the corporate
seats. Exactly. I think that's what it is. And then if you look out at kind of the rest of the Colosseum, you see a lot of dead former slaves.
I thought the reveal of the Sons of Harpies was really cool. It was very creepy. It was. Like, those masks are worth their weight in gold.
It makes you kind of double take. Like, did I just see a Sons of the Harpies? Oh, I did.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
It's about to go down.
I thought that was really cool. I thought it was interesting to see Dany kind of like looking around and wondering what the hell am I doing here? Like I'm trying to prevent this crazy lifestyle, and everyone, both the masters and the former slaves, are like so into it.
Yeah. And she's still playing along though.
And you know, Tyrion debating Hisdar, that stuff was all good. I thought Jorah and Dario both came off really well.
Yeah.
I like Jorah's throwing the spear. Because I genuinely thought, it's like, oh man, he's really gone like the bitter estranged lover route.
Yeah, I thought so too.
But no, that was really cool.
Mm-hmm. Everything on the ground looks badass. I mean, this Colosseum looks fucking amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, film this in a Colosseum. So, like,
I was going to ask you, are you finally happy now that you got to the big leagues? It's not the Bush League tournament.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I've been waiting for. Yeah. They do that overhead shot of it, and I was like, yes.
Yes. I have to bite my tongue so hard sometimes in this podcast. We're going on and on about the shitty, shitty little Bush stadium.
I'm like, backyard wrestling setup.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm trying to figure... So if you're saying that they killed a bunch of slaves, then I don't know. Why would a... I could see this being a slave revolt targeting the wise masters. And also, I thought that was interesting because, you know, we talked about the smirking whore from the earlier part where she was always kind of behind the scenes involved in betraying the Unsullied and things like that.
Yeah.
And I was like, maybe this is a popular uprising, and maybe the smirking whore was even the sister of the former slave that was on Dany's advisory council that she offed.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like this hissing was like they've really turned against Dany. They don't think Dany's gone too far. They're going to just throw all the old masters away. They're going to do away with Dany, and then they're going to rule their own damn selves or something. But you're saying that the slaves being killed doesn't really jive with that.
Yeah, it's very confusing. I'm not sure who these people are. But I think it's supposed to be confusing.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's not like I should be getting this and I'm not. It's just that we're not supposed to know yet.
No, I mean, on second viewing, I thought the exact same way I felt when I got done reading the books. Like, what the fuck just happened? Who are the Sons of Harp? This doesn't really add. Not all the pieces fit together, and it is kind of a whodunit mystery. And I guess you're right. We're not supposed to know. Can we talk about the Unsullied?
Okay, their pathetic stance against the Sons of Harp.
So I defended them when they were fighting in Narrow. This is a fucking arena. Form up, locks. Shields like you're supposedly supposed to do and protect your damn queen. Like this should be I get like maybe you can get overwhelmed by force, but they're not even trying, man.
They're too spread out in that circle you're talking about.
Yeah
they should be in phalanx position.
Yes,
phalanx position, whatever.
Yes, maybe it's not a big one, but yes, they should. They should form up and lock shields and use their spears to keep the guys at bay. Like,
yeah,
I don't fucking get it. Like, why are they why are they betraying the Unsullied?
I don't know, man. Like, it's always surprised me how ineffective the Unsullied have been,
right,
for their reputation.
Well, I mean, in the books, I'm always thinking, like, man, if Dany ever gets across the narrow sea, these Unsullied are going to fuck up Westerosi mounted cavalry.
Yeah.
They're like the classic foil for him. But if they're just standing around twirling their spears, like, you know, with 10 feet between the two them all, it's like, this is going to be a shit show. They're going to be broken and driven.
Yeah.
Is it supposed to be commentary on how kind of like undisciplined they are under Danny? That they're starting to, you know, whore
around. They just
around
forgot all their training? And they're getting soft,
like
weak.
I would think that would be kind of interesting because these guys were not warriors by choice. They're warriors by brainwashing. And if they start coming up with ideas of individuality and like, hey, maybe I want to sing or I want to dance or I want to make pottery or I want to do anything but stick this pointy end into another dude. I don't know.
Well, they need a scene to show us that though, right?
Well, I mean,
like, I think the stuff with the whores starts to show us that a little bit.
Yeah.
But you got to have a scene where, like, you know, a couple of Unsullied become gladiators or whatever and get their asses kicked because they haven't been practicing.
Huh.
And they need to be like, you know, Grey Worm needs to look at that and be like, oh yeah, those guys weren't practicing for the last month.
Maybe need
us
to see a couple desserts. I don't know. Yeah. But maybe the Grey Worm Miss Andy is supposed to suggest that they're starting to think about things other than killing and dying for their queen.
They just haven't drawn a direct enough connection if that's what they're trying to do.
But my fear is it's just really, really lazy choreography.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm always kind of worried about
because
that.
The Jorah and Dario stuff wasn't terrible, but it wasn't great either. Like, you compare this to Hardhome. Like, Hardhome was, you felt stakes, and I know the zombies were moving quickly, but that's the other thing, is like, all the action was very lethargic. Like, the Unsullied's like, defend your queen, they're kind of shuffling over there, and they're kind of moving this way, kind of, no one's really running at a full, there wasn't anything that was really driving the action from a choreography standpoint.
I'm with you.
Like, my heart was in my throat last week, this week I was just like... You know, part of that is I knew it was going to happen, but part of it is also just wasn't very cool.
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, in my opinion, Drogon flies in and saves both the day for Danny and the scene for me.
So are you thinking that Drogon was telepathically or empathically summoned by Danny?
I was the first time I saw it. After listening to the behind the scenes thing, no.
Okay.
It's clear that Danny is... they say this, that she's resigned herself to death, and that's why she closes her eyes, and she is just as surprised as anybody to see Drogon show up.
But I also watched the same thing, and they hinted that, like, that there is some kind of connection, and he knows when she's in danger, which that's what I meant. Like, not telepathic, like, literally Aquaman.
Yeah.
I'm talking about more empathetic, like a beta, he's a beta Zed dragon, he can sense emotions.
That's fine. Yeah, I don't have a huge problem with that. I thought she literally called him in, like, yo, Drogon... Shit's broken bad here. Come help me.
See,
the first time.
Because I, you know, there again, I think it was more subtle and interesting in the books that they heavily implied that Drogon didn't give a shit about Danny. He was there because he smelled a bunch of blood.
He just wanted to kick some ass.
Yeah, there's like all this blood being spilled and sounds of battle, and the dragon's like, fuck yeah, I'm going to feast. And when he gets there, he's just like, you know, eating, and then it's like, you know, this little girl is like trying to get his attention. He's like, who does, you know, what the hell's going on with this? And she kind of has to beat him into submission a little bit. It's a much more active thing.
Yeah, I didn't feel like that at all in this episode.
And, you know, here it's like she just and that's the other thing. Like, wasn't very dynamic. Everything up to Drogon getting rode was really awesome. Like, when he was tearing through the...
Yeah.
Everybody, because he was like, Unsullied were getting set on fire. He didn't give a fuck. It's like, if you were standing upright, you were going to get burnt.
That was amazing.
And they
and it looked phenomenal.
Excellent job. And I actually thought that it was cool that they showed that he was still kind of vulnerable at this age that he is. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's the other thing I'm going to get, because a lot of people are asking me, is like, I thought dragons are supposed to be this impressive thing. Look at the dragon skull that Arya climbed inside in season one. That thing's the size of a station wagon.
Yeah.
That is a Targaryen battle dragon. This is a young pup still.
Yep.
But yeah, she climbs up that like a toddler at a playground trying to get on a monkey bars for the first time.
I didn't have a problem with that. But
like, I expected Miss Sandy to be like, oh, look how big you are. Be careful, sweet. You're so hot.
She's climbing on a dragon for the first time in her life. The dragon's moving around. It's
dude,
in danger, and it's injured, and like... You would have trouble climbing on that fucking dragon.
I'm not the motherfucking dragons. I haven't been dreaming about this for years.
But you're saying that he's there pissed off and wanting to kill things, not that he's there to save her.
What I'm saying. Danny comes across as a much more impressive and awesome individual.
Okay.
Much more in command of the situation. And
yeah.
It's a much more uneasy relationship between her and the beast. And it's less of this, oh, dragon feels in my heart that I'm in trouble and he's going to come swoop me down, swoop down and save me.
Sure.
I realize I'm coming across as a book purist dick.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to stop right now because clearly you were impressed by it. And I think that's, you know, there's much more you guys than there are of us. And hell, I don't even know if my opinion of this being kind of disappointed is universal. So I'm going to stop my bitching.
Okay.
But this whole episode played really pretty flat for me.
Well, that's where we're going to leave the episode. That's the end.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
This podcast is sponsored by Audible, as it has been throughout a lot of this season. And I really like the Audible product. It's a place where you can go and get audio versions of your favorite books. They have over 180,000 audio titles to begin with. And you can get a free 30-day trial by going to audiblepodcast.com/GOT. That's an affiliate link exclusively for Bald Move fans. You can get a free audiobook. Now, if you're just joining us, you'll know that I've been talking this up all season. And one of the big reasons is because they have every one of George Martin's books and the Song of Ice and Fire series completely unabridged. And I think that there's two types of Game of Thrones fans. There's the types that have read the books and there's the types that will. And a great way to read these books are...
What about the types that won't?
They don't exist. You're not a real Game of Thrones fan, Jim.
Okay.
Don't indict yourself. Don't indict yourself. Just let that hang in the air.
Hmm.
But I think it's a great way to experience it because I like to read, but a lot of times I'm too busy. So I get the best of both worlds with my Kindle device. And by the way, if you've got a tablet or if you got any cell phone, you've got a Kindle device. Because when you're reading, all these books are whisper sync enabled. So when you're reading on your Kindle, wherever you leave off, you take your cell phone, you plug it into your car, you go onto the Audible app, it will start reading
exactly where you left off, and you just kind of chain that stuff together into an endless cycle of reading. The Audible people were graciously allowed us to use snippets of the books to kind of market for them, and I'm going to play the climactic part of Dance of Dragons, where Drogon comes out of the sky and rescues Dany, and it goes down a little bit different in the books. I thought that was interesting.
In the smoldering red pits of Drogon's eyes, Dany saw her own reflection. How small she looked, how weak and frail and scared.
I cannot let him see my fear.
She scrambled in the sand, pushing against the pitmaster's corpse, and her fingers brushed against the handle of his whip. Touching it made her feel braver. The leather was warm, alive. Drogon roared again, the sound so loud that she almost dropped the whip. His teeth snapped at her. Dany hit him.
No!
She screamed, swinging the lash with all the strength that she had in her. The dragon jerked his head back.
No!
She screamed again.
No!
The barbs raked along his snout. Drogon rose, his wings covering her in shadow. Dany swung the lash at his scaled belly, back and forth, until her arm began to ache. His long serpentine neck bent like an archer's bow. With a hiss, he spat black fire down at her. Dany darted underneath the flames, swinging the whip and shouting,
No, no, no! Get down!
His answered roar was full of fear and fury, full of pain. His wings beat once, twice, and folded.
So there you go. It's more of a taming of Drogon in the books. And there's a lot of subtle differences that, you know, kind of give you a slightly different take on the characters, a little bit maybe of a deeper appreciation. Sometimes it gives you a little bit more complicated, epic feel. And I think this is one of those cases. So the only way you can compare and contrast and find out for yourself is to actually read the books. And again, Audible's a great service to do that. You can go to audiblepodcast.com/GOT. Sign up, you get a 30-day free trial, and you can download one audiobook for free, such as Dance of Dragons, Feast for Crows, any of those things. I'd like to thank Audible for sponsoring us, and I hope you guys enjoy your free trial.
Why don't we get into some feedback?
Let's see, was there... Okay, sure. Matthew T., so we got a couple, a little bit of old stuff that I want to consider first from the previous episode. Matthew T. said, stray thought based on the... Episode 508 regular cast, going from the idea that there was some ancient agreement with the White Walkers. He's theorizing on my theories. Perhaps that agreement had to do with give us X number of kids every so often. Could it be that's why the Night's Watch vows include that they wouldn't have any kids? He puts forth the scenario of the First Men and Northerners or the Night's Watch precursor humans realizing that the kids they're giving away were just adding strength to the White Walkers. And or they just got more and more skeeved at the thought of giving up the kids or both. Thus, their attorneys found a loophole, and they decided that they would make a condition of being on the Night's Watch.
Okay.
Have no kids. Do you like that?
It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I have no idea if any of this is even close to
me
true.
Me either.
But it, sure, that jives with the theory.
Okay. Tom H. said, after listening to your podcast, I wanted to add to the conversation about the children at Swarm Carsey. When she was in the conference with the elders and Jon Snow, she said the crows killed her brothers and sisters. Surely these were the whites that attacked her. It seemed like a logical story progression that these were her ex-siblings and friends. I did not get that. And if that was the case, then I would expect them to do something a little bit more explicit. Like maybe she'd name her brothers and sisters and she might say one of their names as they rush to kill her.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, if you want to have that as your headcanon... I ain't mad at you. Sam H. said, you almost got me shouting on my iPhone this morning with your discussion of ice spiders and what their inclusion might entail. We know that one major obstacle to the White Walkers invading the realms of men is a 700-foot-high ice wall. Well, what could ice spiders do that White Walkers can't? That is the question you ask and gave no answer to, but the answer is blindingly obvious. They can walk up fucking walls. How did Night's Watch deal with 100 or even 1,000 ice spiders climbing up the wall and attacking them? And the White Walkers riding ice spiders up the wall? Pretty cool.
All right.
My Minecraft experience would suggest that they would just put 1x by 1x blocks all along the top of the wall,
yeah,
you know, and that would just stop all that shit right away. But
it'd be tough to do that with a 500 mile wall
with like 75 dudes that are actually able to work.
And I still don't think that would stop them.
That's kind of exciting, the concept of like hundreds of these ice spiders with the White Walkers run swarming over the walls. Although,
why do you think that White Walkers can ride ice spiders?
Because they talked about them in a previous episode. They were talking about that in the Wildling Council, and they're like, that's a bunch of bullshit.
Sure, okay.
And then the other's like, why don't you? Yeah.
So you're saying, you know, all the other legends are true. Why isn't that one true?
That's a fair question, I think.
Yeah.
All right.
It sounds dangerous.
I think it would be cool. On the news, and the other thing is, like, it just seems more and more that humanity's fucked. Like, they're already fucked when they're just a bunch of undead fuckers. Now that you got, like, ice wall climbing spiders, I might nope out at that point.
Okay.
Or just look away while the ice spiders are mauling people.
Just go over to Essos, man. They can't cross the sea.
All right, on the new stuff. Ryan L. said, wow, I actually have something to contribute. 20-odd years ago, I cut off two of my fingers that were then reattached, but they don't work particularly well. But I also do wood carving as a hobby.
Oh, boy.
From my firsthand, no pun intended, experience, I think Davos is fine with his carving.
Yeah?
Another guy said that, and I think this is true, that he cut off the fingers of his non-dominant hand. His lefty hand.
I think so, yeah.
So... yeah, he just needed all right, like a vice grip, and then he can just whittle with his good hand.
I'm just thinking, like, woodworking today is very different than woodworking whenever this takes place. Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, you got
saws and
sure,
all sorts of tools.
But just whittling, I don't think whittling has changed in thousands of years.
I agree.
Since we first started making flint.
Yeah, are you? So this guy is a whittler? Or is he like...
He says he's a wood carver. He says like, wood carving.
Wood carving.
That
okay.
implies
all right, yeah,
sitting on a porch in a wicker rocking chair with a pocket knife
making
and
pipes,
piece of pine or something.
Yeah,
or deer, stags.
All right.
That you
maybe
can smoke
he's not
from,
so bad
of course.
Yes, there's a bowl in the back.
Nick M says, "I believe I find the true meaning of the faceless men. Everybody in Essos knows that cockles is slang for black market boners. Assassinations are just a hobby for this sacred order. You really think they only save face the faces of the dead they get? They've got the cock merchant market cornered, and they
That's
know
true.
It. The only thing Jackin worships is the dollar bill, yo."
All right. Yeah, so they just need to go to Braavos and find a cock merchant.
All right. I'm
they're everywhere.
Put a little more humor in the mailbag to leaven out the Shireen burnings.
That's a good idea. Yeah.
All right. We're going to get to the main event. A couple people defending Stannis up front. Gabriel H. says, though it was tough seeing Shireen burn, part of me is glad that all the bandwagon Stannis fans have dispersed. Fantasies, I would say. I've always felt that no one really liked Stannis until he saved the day at the Wall. At that point, everybody hopped on the Stannis bandwagon, and the same people are now pissed that he sacrificed his daughter to the Lord of Light. Who exactly did they think Stannis was? Let's not forget that this is the same guy that killed his own brother and was totally about to kill his nephew. It's been made abundantly clear from the beginning that Stannis values duty above everything. His entire army and family, which includes Shireen, face certain death in the cold. With the Lord of Light's magic proven to be real on several occasions, the only way out was to sacrifice Shireen. The outrage that Stannis faces is ridiculous. The events of Season 5, Episode 9 completely fall in line with his story and his tragic character. He remains one of the most fascinating and underrated characters in the series. Jim, your thoughts?
I mean, his only way out remark rings a little false to me. I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm just saying they didn't really show it to us. Like,
it's kind of like Bear Grylls.
Those stakes weren't established.
Bear Grylls and his, you know, man versus wild. Do you really need to drink your own piss here, Bear? Do you really like you just ran out of water 3 hours ago. You're down to drinking your piss. Maybe walk around for a couple hours or a day. See if you find some fresh water. Don't go right to drinking piss. Your food stores were destroyed last night.
Yeah.
Better burn my daughter. I don't know that it works that way. I don't think
especially when you have hundreds and hundreds of pounds of horse meat, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, our food stores got destroyed, but we've got all these horses.
Yeah.
Now that we have
make
to eat.
Make chicken salad out of chicken shit. Maybe separating this by an episode or two and allowing the circumstances to be more desperate and having, like,
Stannis happened to be worn down by it, but man, he just seemed like he jumped right through the daughter burning.
I agree. And I mean, what is this? So I don't know what this is going to get him. Obviously they haven't shown us like how this is going to affect the battle. What do you think the tangible, I don't know if you can say this or it's not in the books, right? We've already passed the books.
That's accurate. The so-called Battle of Winterfell is yet to happen.
So what would you guess would be the tangible result of this sacrifice, and how is it going to help him? Like, how is it going to change the equation of there's a siege we can't win? What the fuck could that possibly get him?
The storm abating so they can, he can take the, cause I'm guessing his forces are still more numerous than the than the Boltons, but
I mean,
he has
Shadow Baby to go in and kill Roos and Ramsay.
But
like,
you could do that without burning your daughter.
Yeah, I don't know where they're Melisandre going with this. I'm really confused.
So resistant to doing that at this point.
I don't know. I'm really confused by where this is going. Yeah, what he could possibly gain. What, like, I just don't know what he thinks he's gaining.
Yeah,
because she hasn't promised anything, right? Other than we'll win this. Promise me something tangible before I burn my fucking daughter.
Well, I mean, I don't know that that's fair because she has done lots of tangible things. Now, again, you could argue they're
coincidence. But tell me what. Tell me what is going to happen before I take this huge step. Not just that something will happen. Something's going to change. I don't know. I didn't feel like it was justified at this point.
I don't think that's the relationship they built up with the Lord of the Light. Like, I don't know. She explained in detail about how shadow babies are formed. See, my lord, sure. You put the penis in the vagina and then the shadow comes out. Like, it was just kind of like, you need to trust me. And the time you didn't trust me, you lost a crushing defeat. And if you had only trusted me, you'd be sitting on the Iron Throne right now. I mean, that is a good justification for why you burn your daughter. I mean, don't literally mean that, but like reminding us of those stakes once again wouldn't have hurt it. And I think they just really needed to let the circumstances be more dire, because
that's the thing. He goes from the speech that he gives Shireen about, you know, how he saved her from Grayscale up at the wall just a couple of episodes ago.
Yes.
Nothing has really changed other than a couple of his horses died, a couple of his men died.
And all of his food is gone, to be fair. But as you said,
but there's a shitload of horse meat.
And it's super cold, so it's not gone bad.
Of course not.
You just have to eat horses.
So it's like, it didn't seem that anything warranted what he did.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah. No, they needed, and that's
the
problem.
But if she had promised, if she had said like, oh yeah, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, we're going to win this battle, and here's how, then maybe, okay, I understand why he's like got what he considers a sure thing.
Yeah.
But at this point, there's no reason to do it, and he doesn't have any kind of assurances that it's going to happen.
Yeah.
I don't know. I hated every aspect of it.
No, I mean...
Least of all, the burning of Shireen.
And this goes back to some jokes we made a couple episodes ago about this terrible snowstorm. If they could have sold that a little bit better... You know, because I've had worse snowstorms in Indiana for sure.
Yeah,
like the wind wasn't biting. Like again, you just had a
But I mean, you got a house to huddle into.
But I'm just saying, like, if this is going to be a storm that's going to keep soldiers, and I get it, they're not equipped for the winter, yada yada yada.
Yeah,
if that's going to keep professional soldiers from pushing forward, I think it needs to be more convincing. All this stuff. You know, making it seem more dire. One thing you can do to make it seem more dire is really sell the cold and how affecting it is.
Like, have them burning a pile of their dead soldiers, right? Like, just a huge mound of dead guys. Oh my God, they're losing soldiers by the dozens.
Or maybe you find, like, some soldier has murdered another one and resorted to cannibalism because he's so desperate.
There you go.
That's the kind of shit that you start thinking, well, maybe you burned a daughter. Maybe, but this is his only heir. Like,
I know, man.
I'm not saying you're wrong, because what you're saying is correct, Gabriel. Mm-hmm. I think that for me, they did not communicate all those things and the true desperation enough. Richard says, didn't anyone have a hate on for Jamie pushing Bran out the window on day one? And now isn't he one of everyone's most favorite characters / good guy?
Mm-hmm.
Fair point.
Yeah,
it is.
It took him a long ass time to get there, though.
And it's really like that's one of those things where when I think about that, it's like cognitive dissonance, because you cannot defend pushing a child out the window.
No,
you can't.
Of course not.
But I love Jamie.
Yeah.
in three more episodes or three more seasons, am I going to be back to Stannis Demanis after he burnt his daughter alive?
Possibly.
I would argue that pushing some rando child out the window is not as bad as burning your only daughter and only heir that you spent a fortune saving and you've had this special relationship with.
I don't know that you need the fortune saving her. I think, you know, your only daughter.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
No, you could stop there. Right?
Every modifier makes the betrayal worse.
Okay, okay.
That's all I'm saying.
It's compounding it, yeah.
So, I don't know.
I agree. But, you know, it did take a long time to get Jamie there. And I'm not saying it's impossible to get me on Stannis' side again. It's just... right now, I fucking hate him.
The contra side, which I think we've handled fairly well, so I'm only going to pick one. Natalie H. says, I've been thinking about Stannis allowing Shireen to be burnt. I can't think of anything to justify his actions. I think by letting Shireen burn, it's cost him not only his daughter, who arguably meant the most to him, but also who he is as a person. He's scarifying his integrity and all of his values. What is left of Stannis as a man after this? Even in a best-case scenario, he sits on the Iron Throne. That victory must be very hollow and a very lonely one.
He needed Tyrion there to say, okay, let's say for a moment that you burn your daughter and you get the throne. Then what?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Having scarred the things that mean the most to him, not to mention that you would have to question how good of a king or leader he would be if he wouldn't win without having to resort to these measures. How would many people trust and respect him? If his daughter, the one person who he should have had an undivided loyalty to, is the very person he not only betrayed and failed to protect, but also had a hand in killing in such a horrific way? All good questions.
Yep.
And there were well over 100 people taking probably 9 to 1 on the against versus for.
Yeah.
But just couldn't read them all. But,
okay.
I hope you feel like you were heard. And we'll talk some more on the spoiler section too, if you're a book reader wanting to get some more book material in your arguments. Paul W. says, I'm hoping this results in triumph of science over religion. What if Shireen's grayscale has lain dormant and the fire activates it and sends it airborne? I would love to see Stannis' whole camp being afflicted with grayscale at this point. It's got, you take poison ivy, you burn it on a fire, and then you get inhalation exposure, and it's just a bad deal. Maybe
I like it.
They've weaponized grayscale.
Let's do it. I hope Melisandre and Stannis both get it. And Davos is saved because he rode off before then.
Narshalone says, regarding Trystane and Myrcella coming to King's Landing, could Doran be plotting to take over the Iron Throne through Trystane? With both Cersei and Margaery in jail, all they need to do is get Tommen to give up the throne or arrange to have him removed somehow, and Myrcella is suddenly the sole claimant to the throne. Heck would even fulfill Cersei's prophecy from the first episode of the season about a queen more beautiful than her replacing her. I feel that Alexander Siddig's abilities as an actor have been wasted thus far, and showing him have a deeper scheme would flesh him out, possibly make the whole Dorne side plot matter.
Okay.
You think that's it? They're trying to put Trystane one heartbeat away from the king core consortship?
Seems like it.
Hmm.
It does. I don't know why. I don't know, because he's in the exact opposite position of what he was an episode ago, right?
Where
instead of having one of the Lannisters' kids in his kingdom, now it's the other way around.
Which is not, on the face of it, doesn't seem like a strengthening of one's position.
It seems dangerous, yeah.
Because the ultimate defense of that is just slit Trystane's throat on the way to King's Landing and dump his body overboard. Now you're risking open war at Dorne.
Well, I think that would be... a little foolish. I mean, you could use him as a hostage, like they feared that they were going to do with Myrcella,
right? Exactly.
Like,
so now you've not only...
I'm trying to read him. Like, does he trust the Lannisters to be like he is? To not be vindictive and...
No. Surely not.
I wouldn't think
then Doran's an idiot.
But what is he doing then, right? Like, I get... Okay, maybe he's trying to get him close, but that's a very dangerous move.
Yeah.
An extremely dangerous move for him.
Sure. You lose a hostage and you give
huge
them...
Huge risk.
You give them a hostage.
Yeah. And you, if you know them to be the lunatics that they are, that's almost dumb. That's dumb of him.
I mean, if
he does that. Which is why I'm saying, like, does he know?
Do you think there's going to be some kind of double-crossing? But why?
I feel there has to be. Otherwise, what's the
like?
Point
I'm thinking
of this?
It's like, well, like, so they're sailing, and it turns out that's actually Prince Doran's ship, and he betrays Jaime and murders him and Bronn. why wouldn't you just do it there if that's what your plan is?
Because it makes him look more guilty, but how is he going to do
actually
it?
Actually make it be a shipwreck? Yeah, but that kills your son. I know. Now you put your son in the boat.
It seems... Is it also possible that he is just so benevolent that he thinks...
Does he seem benevolent when he grabs her and says, you talk to me one more time, I'm going to kill you? I believe in... That's the thing, like...
Well, there's a difference between the betrayal that she committed and him being angry about that versus, you know, wanting to rule his kingdom in a way that is good and just.
See, my read on him in that first episode where he's just sitting there straight backed in his wheelchair and he's like just gripping his armrest and he's seething. Like, part of that plays that he's just tired of Ilaria screaming in his ear. But part of that sure. is he's just as pissed off at his Oberyn situation as she is. Mm-hmm. It's just he is a Michael Corleone type and she's a Sonny. But
I don't
this
see
move
what
is sending
plan...
Tristan off as a hostage makes him almost Fredo. Like, what the fuck, Doran?
Yeah.
It's a fucking Fredo move. Anyway.
There must be something else under the surface there
going
on. I just don't see what it is.
I am with child to find out.
Yeah.
Narsalone continues. Also, since Ramsay knows that a key part of the plot is to light a candle at the highest tower. I like this one a lot. It makes sense that he would light the candle himself and go ahead and spring the trap. After all, the fact that this plot exists means that there are Stark loyalist forces outside your castle, so what better way to expose them than by activating them at a time when you are perfectly prepared for them? Otherwise, you have no way of knowing what else might trigger their response, and it might be at a totally inopportune moment. Is Ramsay a genius or is he a fucking idiot? Because this is right on, man.
It's right on. Maybe he's saving it up. Maybe he's like, you know what, I'll spring this when I'm ready.
But then he goes outside the castle to go do mischief at night.
Possibly to get killed. And then he knows that Stannis' army is out there and he's going to let someone in the gates when he lights the candle. Like,
yeah.
How does Brienne get back in? They should be all sieged up, right? Like closed for business.
I feel like this is the podcast where most people are going to figure out the dark side of the bald move podcasts. Like, you know, like we've been virtually indistinguishable from a fan cast to this point, and now we've just turned on it with knives, like just calling bullshit left. This is
but not for good.
No, I know, but I'm saying
not without
like,
cause.
Do you remember when we started with Walking Dead, and there was a point where we're like, this is bullshit. It doesn't make sense. And a lot of the fanboys and girls were like, we don't like you anymore. We just I wonder if we're hitting the tipping point. Or it could be there's a lot of people just pissed off at the episode. I don't know.
I think a ton of people are pissed off at this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, they could this could be part of their master plan.
Yeah.
Or
doesn't feel like it's being executed as well as previous seasons, honestly.
Well, that's what my fear is, that this is a big convoluted mess of a plot. Mm-hmm. And there's no more information to really give concrete guidance past that. So you are steering a ship into murky waters with no clear roadmap out of this. At the worst, most knotted up part in the plot.
Yeah.
Ugh. Scott R.
What if the other two books just never come out?
Well,
what if they are never released?
Or
because Martin can't figure it out.
And that's one thing,
because
you could then kind of choose your own adventure. I think the worst case scenario for fans, and I speak as one myself, is that Martin's written himself in a corner and he doesn't really have.
Well, that's what I mean. Like he just says
he might have
a
really great idea to end it, but it's not going to make sense getting there, and it's going to be.
But he's going to write the books anyway,
well,
and they're
going to
be bad until the very end.
I mean, you either just don't write the books, which again, I think that'd be preferable to writing bad ones.
Yeah,
but. You know, everything's up in the air.
The show does not have that luxury. The show must go on.
No,
and
it's...
I don't know that I like all of where it's going.
Yeah.
Like I did in the previous seasons.
Well, maybe next episode will be another hard home and we can put all this behind us. Scott R. said, I have a question concerning the contagiousness of Grayscale and Jorah Mormont. A lot of people wondering this. The Stone Men touched Jorah... And he got Grayscale during the epic Jorah and Tyrion hell sailing through Valyria. This leads to my question. When does Grayscale become communicable through touch? It's theorized on your show that if Jorah touched any part of Tyrion's skin during the rescue, then he could have passed the disease on. I was really curious about this last night during the epic Sons of the Harpy battle when Jorah reached out and touched Dany with both of his hands to help lead her to safety. Mm-hmm. I let out an audible shout of, no, don't touch her! Much to the dismay of my wife, who wasn't as concerned about Dany becoming a stone man as I apparently was.
I feel like you got to touch the actual grayscale.
Probably. Isn't that how smallpox works? Like you
If you wash your hands, you're kind of fine. But if you touch like the boils and stuff, that's where the disease is manifesting.
Yeah, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say that's it. Because Tyrion has not gotten grayscale that we know of.
And those dudes were ate up with grayscale, like head to toe. Yeah. There was no part of them that was not touched by it.
Yeah, so any touch from them does it.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, I don't think it... Yeah, I mean, just... Your skin's a pretty effective barrier against bacteria and germs. Unless it's actively infected.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to go with that too, unless proven otherwise. In which case, Dany's got yet another problem.
Oh, yeah. She'll just turn into a dragon. She'll get dragon scales instead of grayscale.
Then who rides her?
Tyrion.
Who's the dragon? Tyrion?
Obviously, yeah.
Drogon. Turnabout's fair play. Drogon rides Dany. Alan C. says, after calming down from the mind-blowing second half of last night's episode, I was thinking about why Drogon wasn't able to simply demolish the Sons of the Harpy. Could it be that a dragon can only do so much without a rider? The best analogy I can think of is a German Shepherd. You can have a cute and lovable German Shepherd as your pet, and if a burglar breaks in, they can bark and provide some protection. But in order to get the tactical and aggressive police canine unit of the German Shepherd fame, they need to be trained properly and have a handler to command them. Is a dragon the same way? Can a dragon do only so much by themselves, meaning it takes a badass dragon rider to train them and pilot them like a truly Top Gun dragon?
Could be. I suppose. Why not?
Yeah. Is she going to do is she going to buzz the Tower of the Hand?
Yes.
I think this makes a lot of sense, because a dragon, like, these aren't the dragons of Tolkien that are like clever and intelligent and engage in riddle stories. These seem to be just bestial creatures.
Seems like it, yeah.
So it makes sense that you have to have a intelligent being directing your devastation, or else it's just going to be, you know, still formidable. I wouldn't want to fight one, but not something that a combined army could take them out.
Yeah, and I felt like, you know, it shot fire a couple times, and maybe there's like a gland that produces this fire material, like some sort of flammable something in its body, and maybe it can't, because it stopped shooting fire at one point.
Well, he did get stabbed in the neck. It could just be the pain.
Yeah, I guess.
Or it also could be that he stopped shooting fire when Dany was approaching him because he didn't want to roast her.
It almost seemed like maybe he tried.
To breathe fire on her?
Yeah, he roars right in her face. I wonder if that was just like,
see, that's the
he's
debate.
Out of
that's
juice.
The debate we had with the other dragons. And they, I think, consciously avoided breathing fire on her because they are clearly could.
They could have, yeah.
They were just pissed off and hormonal teenage dragons. I wonder if that's going to be one of the tensions of the book. That Dany knows her dragons aren't battle tested, but she has to use them. And I wonder what the will it be silly to see like people mourning a death of a dragon?
Yeah, why would people other than Dany be connected to these dragons emotionally?
Yeah, but I mean, would we be sad on her behalf? Because that's the thing, is Emilia Clarke is kind of all over the place for me as an actor. I thought the first half of season one, she was terrible. She got really good in season two. She was pretty terrible. And season three and four, like, I remember her being fairly good. And this year it's kind of back to like, I don't know, man. She just got this dead-eyed stare when she's climbing Drogon. Like, there was just no passion or really anything about it.
Huh.
So I'm wondering if
I mean, what was she actually climbing, right? Like, she's climbing some green velvet monstrosity they built.
It's called the art of acting for a reason. So like that.
I know, but come on,
you
and McGregor can't be at fault for Star Wars.
He sold the hell out of riding that shrieking, screaming lizard thing. I will have you know, Ewan McGregor was not the problem with Star Wars.
Indeed, he was not.
What the hell was I saying? Oh, it just makes me worry, because you're right. If we feel anything at all from a potential dragon sacrifice, it's going to be through the lens of her.
Yeah.
And I don't know that she's going to be able to sell that for us.
I don't know. We'll have to wait and see, I guess.
Well, she sold Drogo dying. So I guess if Drogon would die, I care at least as much as I did Cal. Jordan L. Got a lot of Magic the Gathering fans that emailed us.
You know, I'm not surprised.
Excited that we talked about Magic the Gathering.
You're kidding me. People who are fans of Game of Thrones are also fans
of
Magic
the
Gathering.
We need to talk to WotC, get a sponsorship.
There you go. Yeah, we'll
give
sponsor
away a pack a week or something.
D&D 8.0 or whatever they're on
Magic, man. It's all about Magic.
Wait, you think the people who are Magic fans are not also D&D fans?
I'm just saying the subset's a lot bigger.
Okay.
Like, yeah. Magic pays the bills over at WotC or Hasbro or whatever the hell they are now.
Yeah.
Jordan L. says, after Hard Home, I was trying to figure out where all the Valyrian steel is, which led me to the question, is it mentioned in the books that the throne of Westeros is made out of Valyrian steel? It'd be cool symbology to see the throne taken apart to make swords for the people who defend against the White Walkers as leaders must give up the pursuit of power of the throne and work as equals to do the same, which supports Aeron's democratic, non-Joffrey-like-ish society theory.
That would be fucking cool.
Here's the thing. I don't think those are Valyrian steel swords, but guess how the Iron Throne was made?
I don't know.
Aegon melted all the swords of the conquered kings and lords with his dragon.
All right.
So if one of the theories is the dragons that Valyrian steel is essentially steel that's been tempered by dragonfire, then every one of those things are now Valyrian steel.
Interesting.
That would.
I think it'd be awesome to see that thing dismantled and reforged into like 100 swords.
It would be cool. And I've never heard that before ever. So if that ends up being, it's a first, Jordan, I will have your back on that claim. Mike says, do you guys think that Dany consciously called Drogon to her? I got the sense that she was holding Missandei's hand and closing her eyes was more to show that she was resigning herself to death. We actually end up talking about, you brought that point up.
Yeah, and he's right.
Okay, so let's move on to point the second. On another note, where the hell was Grey Worm in this episode? Are we supposed to believe he's still recovering from his injuries all the way back in episode 4? How much time has passed since then? It seems like he would be capable of at least attending the games with them, considering the threat of the Sons of the Harpy. Good fucking question.
Yeah.
Where the hell is Grey Worm?
Dead? I don't know. Maybe that was his last stand.
If he died and we don't know about it, no. That's terrible.
Of course not. That would be
horrible.
That's
terrible.
I don't know. Probably, yeah, still recovering. I don't know. I can't tell how long it's taken place between those two episodes.
It's hard for me to believe that they'll write him a scene for the last episode of the season, but man, I kind of feel like I need to. Because if he's seriously hurt bad enough, he can't just stand in her box as a ceremonial honor guard type person.
Still? Yeah. Seems like a pretty grave injury then.
Yeah. Alexander C., Jorah and now Tyrion have had their cynicism of the world destroyed at the sight of Dany's dragons. But why do her dragons indicate that she's such an inspirational leader? Many Targaryens of yore rode dragons, a lot of whom were terrible or insane. The Targaryens, not the dragons, to be clear. Also, dragons aren't seen as a Westerosi myth the way the White Walkers are. They're a historical reality from just a couple hundred years ago. I understand how seeing walkers would blow people's minds, but they know dragons were around in relatively recent history. So why are Jorah and Tyrion's cynical worldviews so dramatically reversed? That's a good question. I thought about, like, intellectually, I know there are blue whales in the ocean, but if I were in the middle of the Pacific and one swam right underneath me, I think it would be a life-changing experience.
Okay.
So it could be that, yes, you're aware that at one time there were dragons and the last of them died out 100 years ago. But seeing them with your own eyes.
But I mean, they've seen one before. Jorah and Tyrion have both seen dragons. I think it was more the suddenness of the appearance right there.
What?
Going, oh, God, this isn't a dragon 15 miles away in the sky. This is a dragon right in my fucking face.
Well, also that she's finally living up to her potential of Mother of Dragons. Like that's kind of amazing that this guy came and kicked so much ass, and then she just jumped. She just swung a leg over him and rode off.
That's pretty cool, yeah.
That's the epic part of it. I don't think it quite got there technically, but maybe that explains.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very different thing, right? I mean, even like an airplane, right? Seeing an airplane in the sky is nothing compared to seeing one up close in person.
But as far as why they're excited about it, inspirational wise, I guess it's because Dany seems like a good person. She doesn't seem like she's evil.
She's a little naive and inexperienced, but she seems benevolent.
But I think the jury is out because I know in the books, I thought they said this in a television show too, that they've mentioned that the Mad King wasn't always the Mad King. He was actually kind of a popular dude until he started losing his mind and getting very paranoid and suspicious late in life. So this goes back to something I talked about episodes ago. I think the jury is very much still out about what kind of ruler Dany will become.
and whether she's the big bad or the big good or whatever remains to be seen.
Okay.
Which is surprising this late into the damn series. Virgilio V, which has an awesome name. It sounds very Bravosi. It's more or now more likely the Sons of Harpies are actually foreign infiltrators, maybe sent from the other slaver cities, maybe sent by enemies of Dany or the Targaryens in general. This would also explain why they're such capable fighters against the Unsullied and would make Barristan's death against them more palatable. Fortunately, Tyrion is around to see who's behind the Sons of Harpy. Dany's current small council has been ineffective and ill-equipped to solve the puzzle. Do you think that it's potential that we're wrong, that it's not the Wise Masters, nor is it the former slaves, it's actually some foreign element that is destabilizing Dany for some unknown purpose?
I mean, I considered part of that, you know, that it might be sellswords, because, like I said before, they were such good fighters. I think I said that in a previous episode.
Yeah, they do seem like they have. Like, if these are just former slaves and wise masters, why the expertise in martial affairs?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess the question would be who is leading them, right? Is it from within or without? It seems like...
And what would be the motivation?
I don't know why it couldn't be someone from outside the city, but I mean, that would be a little bit weird given that she came up and like she came in and stirred up the city, right? Like who else would be super mad about that?
All right, so
the other slave cities, but
they've kind of dealt with them. Here's my
they've dealt with them, and like wouldn't they be working with the people inside Meereen? Like aren't the people in Meereen just as pissed, if not more pissed about it?
Well, I'm sure they are. I think they probably are, and maybe that's where the smirking horror comes in and all that other stuff.
Maybe it's like a joint force, but...
I'm thinking, like, here's my tinfoil thought. It's all about the Karth. You know, she murdered one of their 13 rulers and stole his fortune. She set the warlocks on fire. Lots of people pissed about her. And then, because they also are all about the merchant trade, they're all about their own riches and self-interest. She destroyed one of the leading industries of their region, the slave empire, which has got to affect... I mean, she just gutted it. She took out all the great slave cities. That's got to make them pretty pissed from an economic standpoint.
Yeah.
Maybe they're the ones pulling the strings.
Okay, I can buy that.
Jake, quick question. Is it possible Arya has a face on that we are not, as an audience, able to see? Like, if she puts on a face, they have to get a new actor to play Arya for that time. So to prevent confusion and whatnot, they don't show us if she's got a face on. What will her wearing a face look like to us as a viewer? That's a really good question. I don't think this is actually happening.
Yeah.
Because if they were doing that, I would suggest that they would do kind of like a quantum leap deal where they show her in front of the mirror.
Yeah.
And we see that she looks different, but she looks the same to us, to kind of suggest.
They would have to. They haven't done
because
a single thing.
Because you're right. Why would you
it?
Pull Maisie Williams off her game to give her a different face on some of the potentially juiciest stuff she has to work with?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. They haven't indicated in any way that that's what they're doing. And if it is, it's terrible, but...
I agree. That's
I don't think it is.
I want to say no way, Jake, because if they are pulling that and it's a retcon... But also, we didn't talk about this. Meryn Trant, Serpedo, he gave a lot of eye fucks over to Arya. Is that because he's just a pedophile that was lusting after a underage girl?
Could be.
Or is it because there is a shadow of recognition from years ago? Or is it all of the above?
You know, the first time through, I read it as a shadow of recognition. The Me second too. Time through, knowing who
That's
he
true,
is.
Because we didn't know that he was a pedophile at that point.
No, So the second time through, it's like, yeah, maybe there's a little bit more to it. But I think he definitely like half recognized her.
Yeah.
But he had more pressing matters at the moment.
I think it's probably a little combination A and B.
Okay.
Yeah. Enver M says, what do you make of Hisdar's death? I'm not buying it. To me, it looks staged, and I wouldn't be surprised if the episode opened next Sunday with him removing his Meereenese Kevlar vest with a piece of goat liver taped around it or whatever other animal internal organs you could use to simulate bleeding after being stabbed. I mean, his reason for being late was that he had to make sure everything was quote-unquote in place or, quote, in order, and the camera stays an extra second longer on him being conspicuous about his tardiness. It could be the Double D's messing with us and debunking the Hisdar mole leader of the Harpies theory, and if I'm onto something, Why would he take himself out like that, faking his own death so he could pull the strings in secret, when the most effective strategy would have been an insider in the enemy's camp?
Yeah. That's a question, right? To what end?
Yeah. My gut says,
what does this change?
My gut says that he was a son of one of the sons of the Harpies, and he was betrayed after his usefulness was over. They thought this was going to be the kill shot, and they didn't want any, I don't know, but why would they care about witnesses at that point?
So maybe this is a thing where, I don't know.
Like,
right?
this was intended.
I mean, he could
like,
probably lead them
if
to.
Not, can we agree that if not for Drogon, she's dead?
Yes, I agree with that.
So if they planned on this to be an assassination, why would they want to kill? I mean, man, it makes me look innocent
now. If it doesn't work, he could lead them back to the people who.
But the other thing is, if it doesn't work, he's still placed to be in her inner circle.
It's tough to say. Now,
I can't see any way to make this work. Not saying it's not.
So what if that's what happened, right? So he goes in there thinking, okay, everything's in place. We're going to attack the queen and all this. And he gets assassinated, or there's an attempted assassination on him.
Right on.
He lives through it, and he turns against them and leads her to the Sons of the Harpy.
That would be interesting.
Because they betrayed him.
That would be interesting. Not as interesting as them just figuring out on their own.
Yeah. But yeah, that's not as interesting as sending Dario in.
That's a well-worn trope. The bad guys overplay their hand and try to do treachery and it wakes the person up. Like, it's like, that wouldn't be unheard of. Again, I don't think it's as interesting as them just figuring out what the hell it is on their own. Because I think we kind of desperately need to see Tyrion do something really cool.
And I agree.
Him figuring out the Sons of Harpy's problem and taking charge of the situation would be welcome for me.
I bet they're saving the cool stuff for Tyrion. Although Tyrion might die in this next episode. I don't know. He's still not completely out of trouble.
The other obvious candidate for treachery would be Dario. Because...
Man, yes, I know. Everyone keeps bringing up Dario. Dario's the leader of the Sons of the Harpy. I don't know, man. I like Dario too much.
I don't know why he would ingratiate himself with her. Maybe he's mad that she rejected him and that his plan was to lead her out into safety and have his Dar be killed. But man, why would you engineer a citywide revolt just for that? Dario's a man that seems like he can kill his Dar just without trying.
Yeah.
And probably make it look kind of like an accident.
Yeah.
Your Grace,
I'm not on board
slipped
with
in
that,
a puddle of urine in the toilet today and broke his neck. Hell of a thing.
Yep. Happens.
Jeff Inn. It's been a few episodes since we've seen Varys or Littlefinger, and for you two guys who like to manipulate things behind... For two guys who like to manipulate things behind the scenes, that's a lot of time to be plotting and scheming. Has Littlefinger rallied the troops of the Vale? For what family? What neck of the world is Varys in? Working with Olenna Tyrell again? What do you think Littlefinger and Varys' next moves are, and will we see them in episode 10?
I don't know, man. We debated Littlefinger's next move, you know, right after he... told Cersei, yeah, I'll go in and mop up and bring you Sansa's head. There hasn't been any movement on that whatsoever.
So there's the happiest of endings, right? The Boltons and the Baratheons beat the shit out of each other.
Yeah.
One emerges as a victor. And maybe they've even got a, it's a hard-fought and ill-won victory. And then Littlefinger comes and crushes them with the Knights of the Vale.
Yeah, save Sansa, and
they've got
everyone lives happily ever after.
They've got climbing gear, and they're spanning the walls, and they just it's a total victory.
Yeah, that would be cool. Varys is the wild card, right? Like, where the hell
is
Varys? Did he just go? Oh well, when Tyrion got kidnapped.
Yeah,
guess I'm going back to King's Landing.
Yeah,
I don't know.
You would think I was kind of waiting to see if he would show up at some point with Danny, because he wanted to go there too, or maybe he thinks he can be better serving her somewhere else.
I don't know. I have no idea what he's doing at the moment.
Yeah, but it's probably plotting and scheming.
Yeah.
Second point: are we sure Shireen is dead? Could her grayscale have protected her in some way? Game of Thrones has seemingly killed people before, only to reveal that they are alive. Brandon Stark and the Mountain, we think, are the first two that come to mind. Even if Shireen is dead, could Mel revive her like the Red Priest Thoros, bringing back Beric Dondarrion? What gives? Did Shireen have to die? Why not just leech her blood? This is the last question. I don't know. I really don't know. It could be that Melisandre is just fucking around with all his blood magic and nothing is really actually working. It's just all superstition and bullshit.
Yeah.
But the shadow baby is, again, it's not blood magic. It's semen magic, but it makes me want to not discount all the other stuff.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
The other question is Shireen still alive?
I don't know. Her screaming stops in that episode conspicuously. Melisandre smiles. I don't think so.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to say no. We never see her actually, burnt up.
But what would that be like? Because,
Husk.
Beric Dondarrion was fucked up. He's missing an eye. He was scarred up. He was like, looks like he was burnt. Like, resurrecting Shireen would be like a monkey's paw type situation. It would be horrific.
Yeah. Which,
I'm not saying that Game of Thrones wouldn't go there, but it's not like something I'm holding out hope for. I'd avoid the monkey's paw situation.
I was going with the idea in that email that grayscale, it makes you fireproof somehow.
Oh.
Like a Dany sort of situation where everything burns around her and she comes out looking
but she's
no
not
worse for wear.
Covered in grayscale. She's covered, so you'd have one.
But it like changes your blood or something. I don't buy it. I don't buy it. I don't think grayscale does anything to make you fireproof.
Yeah.
I think you got to be a dragon mother for that.
That would be interesting if she kind of had her Dany moment. And what would that mean?
Yeah.
If I was Stannis,
I don't think so, man.
I would kill Stannis and then follow her.
With the way she was screaming on that thing and the way it stops. Yeah, I don't think she's alive.
Yeah.
No way, no how.
Not going to be rewatching this episode very often.
Yep.
And as for fuck that scene, I watched a second because I'm a professional, but I don't want to ever hear those screams again. That's terrible.
It was horrifying on the level of like when it sounded like a pig being slaughtered.
Yeah.
Like slowly.
Like the screams of terror being from going to
just it's, sheer pain and terror. And like,
yeah.
It was really well done for the effect they were going for.
Like when Rob's pregnant wife got stabbed in the stomach, I thought that was about as bad as they can get from a physical violence.
Ooh, no.
No. And that was hard to watch, but like I've seen the Red Wedding episode several times more since then. But this, like the first time I actually turned the volume down because I'm like, Jesus Christ, if my son is still awake, this is a bad deal. He's
Daddy,
like, what is dad? Why
there?
Is that little girl screaming? Like, I'm uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you're watching that scene
These
on an
are the
airplane.
Types of shows I
you
watch son.
That scene on an airplane, you start like shielding. Like, I don't know if this is appropriate for public.
Yeah, don't watch Game of Thrones on an airplane. What are you doing? Common courtesy, people.
I've heard of people watching porn on airplanes.
Oh, my God.
That blows me away.
Those people need to be burnt at the stake.
There you go. That's who you burn.
Yep.
Porn watchers on airplanes. All right, Jim. If they got more, if that's all the feedback we got for this week, if they got more they'd like to send us, next week probably is going to be a big week. Not really sure.
Maybe. Yeah, I'm hoping for a Winterfell battle. I don't think I'm going to get it, though.
Yeah? Okay. I'm not sure how they're going to give us a traditional last minute shot in the arm to carry us on to season 6, but I'm hoping they got something up their sleeve. The killing of Meryn Trant. We'll be back covering that with our instant cast on Sunday night, as soon as the episode's over. You can also send us feedback at gameofthrones@baldmove.com and get on our forums at forums.baldmove.com. We got spoiler threads, non-spoiler threads. I'll be back Friday to have a spoiler edition where we'll talk about whether Stannis lives up to his character in the books, among other things.
All right. Sounds good.
And you can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter to get our releases as soon as they drop.
Okay. Well, then you'll see Aaron on Friday and you'll see me on Sunday. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See you.